This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. All three of the candidates for the GOP nomination for governor in Iowa say they want the state to challenge the federal health care overhaul program in court. Minnesota governor and oft-rumored presidential hopeful Tim Pawlenty wants his state to do the same. So will the elections this fall, even for state and local races, be dominated by the health care issue? That's one of the topics we'll talk about today on Talk of Iowa. ISU political science professor Stefan Schmidt and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson will be our guests. We'll talk about the healthcare issue, other matters of political interest, and take your phone calls and emails. Politics Day coming up on Talk of Iowa after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. It's Politics Wednesday. Stefan Schmidt, ISU political science professor, is joining us, as is Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. Stefan, Arnie, welcome.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's start with the health care in the context of all three of the GOP candidates for governor in Iowa want to have the state join in the effort of fighting the federal health care overhaul in court. Tim Pawlenty, who everyone expects to run for president, wants Minnesota to do the same. So my question to start off today's show for both of you is, do we suspect that even gubernatorial local races, non-federal races, are going to be dominated in the fall by the health care issue?
Oh, absolutely. Don't you think it's like the Velcro that's holding the Republican Party together? I mean, they have now, you know, drawn a line in the sand, and they have made health care the Antichrist. And they are therefore going to protect us from the Antichrist. So health care has got to be issue number one. So speaking against health care reform, marginalizing health care reform, demonizing health care reform, making health care reform basically being, you know, almost the call for another American revolution is essential. I think there's going to be a lot of call for that. But I'm wondering how many governors, you know, we had a civil war once, and the civil war was about, you know, dividing the country between the North and the South. It was about slaves as chattel and not as people. Isn't it fascinating that the next civil war might be about saving lives as opposed to marginalizing lives? It's really remarkable to me.
The problem with this health care thing is that it's a story that has a lot of legs, and it has very interesting legs. For example, Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts is very angry, and Massachusetts, the Division of Insurance in Massachusetts, I think it was yesterday, denied 235 hikes in Massachusetts in premiums that were proposed by insurers in plans that cover individuals and small businesses. And, you know, Massachusetts is a health care model, and we know that Mitt Romney created this universal health care in Massachusetts. And yet, in spite of all that, which was being held up as sort of the state level equivalent of national health care, and this is a way to go, and you see the Republicans ought to buy in on that, and yet the Massachusetts health care program is, you know, in some difficult times, and the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, which is the largest provider, I gather it is in many states, are talking about that the fact that they are concerned about the rising health care costs, and insurance companies are the ones who, of course, are billed for it. And I think it was the vice president of Blue Cross Blue Shield said, you know, government price controls on health care premiums are a problem and not a solution, because otherwise, if insurance companies will just simply not insure anymore if they're going to be billed more than they're bringing in on premiums. I mean, they are businesses. So this is a serious problem.
Let me weigh in a little bit on the conversation about Massachusetts. Massachusetts made a calculated decision, and it probably was a mistake. The decision was, before we control costs, we're going to drive everyone into this very expensive system that up until right now has no real incentive to lower costs. So So it's like telling everyone, instead of being able to, you know, have access to a nice little Volkswagen, we're going to now insist that you buy yourself a Lexus. And a Lexus isn't really what you need. You know, it's way more, it's more expensive, it's not necessary. You know, it's good transportation, but it's not necessary transportation. So part of Massachusetts' problem is that it didn't get to the cost control issue, which I think Barack Obama clearly understood and a lot of Democrats understood, which is one of the reasons why this healthcare reform bill, Jonathan, takes so many damn years to actually happen. This happens in 2011, this happens in 2014, this happens in 2020. I mean, and part of the reason why they keep staggering it and pushing it out is they're praying that they can control costs before it gets to that point where we're going to see this kind of more universal inclusion, number one.
I'm not arguing with that. I'm arguing for the fact that the politics of healthcare is a bipartisan political issue, and it's not just the Republican governors who are going to fight against national health care. Deval Patrick, as far as I remember, is a Democrat in Massachusetts, is a very Democratic state. And this is the first time the governor issued an emergency regulation in February, marking the first time ever that Massachusetts has utilized its authority to turn down health premium rises. So, you know, what I'm saying is there may be more to this than just a partisan, you know, Velcro that the Republicans can use to beat up the Democrats. There are serious other issues that are real life issues that are out there in spite of health care reform that some people fear are going to be escalate because of health care reform. I tried to get an appointment yesterday just to share. We share a little bit of our personal connection to these things. I had a little surgery. This is the year afterwards. I went into, you know, the facility, and I said, I need to make an appointment. 2 months from now, they can give me an appointment. And there is no health care reform yet.
Under the private system. Remember that, Stefan. This is not single payer. This is not Canada. This is not Great Britain. This is Great America. It took you 2 months.
Well, exactly. And just think what's going to happen when 30 million additional people are going to want to go in there and make their appointments to get their post-op checkup. You know, increasing the number of people that we drive to a healthcare system that is already overburdened, in which a lot of doctors are simply not taking any Medicare patients anymore. I mean, you can give people. This is like Seinfeld. You know, you reserve a car, you get to the car rental place, and they say, "I'm sorry, we don't have any cars." And Seinfeld says, "But I have a guaranteed reservation." And they say, "Yes, you do, but we don't have any cars." You know, you can have healthcare coverage and health insurance and all that, but if you can't find any doctor who's going to treat you, and in fact, you're covered, but you can't get health care, then there is another side to this whole process that is somehow missing from the entire national health care program, which we've talked about before, which is the system is already overburdened, and we need to create many more facilities, doctors, train doctors, have nurses, and have all kinds of alternative ways of treating people.
Well, it's a jobs bill. Well, it's a job. I mean, remember, Barack Obama is now talking about the economy stupid, and it's a jobs bill. But I want to go back to where we sort of started this with, which is what Tim Pawlenty is doing, because Governor Pawlenty is basically saying to his attorney general, "I want you to sue." The attorney general says, "I don't want to sue." So Tim Pawlenty, who is obviously not looking at Minnesota but looking at his presidential career, is saying, "Okay, well, I will sue independent of you."
Right.
Now, I'm a little confused here. What's the job of an attorney general, and what's the job of a governor? Can he do this? Can the governor sue, or is the governor going to sue as Tim Pawlenty, also known as governor, but not really in his capacity as governor?
Well, in most places, the AG is elected independently of the governor and is actually one of the statewide elected officials. And while technically part of a governor's administration, I think these are sort of questions that haven't come up before, and there may be some constitutional issues and some cool court cases that are going to come out of this.
So let's the original question, going back to is this going to dominate even non-federal elections?
Yeah.
And you both believe it will. The next question is, do you think the tactic will work?
Well, I go back to what I said before, Jonathan, which is it's going to take so long for this system to actually go into effect. It's a 90-day requirement for certain things, a one-year requirement for certain things, a 200-day requirement. And part of the problem is is that will there be enough of a change noticeable to enough people without harming those that currently have insurance, that all that can happen before Election Day of November of 2010, which is only a sprint away. What? And that's problematic. There's a fabulous piece done by Congressional Quarterly where they sort of looked at the sort of the six challenges facing the administration to roll out this health care plan. And I'm telling you, it is mind-boggling whether, you know, an administration that is already facing so many holes in the economy and trying to respond to those holes can take on this new enormous burden and be prepared by a November election so that people can actually tell that health care reform has made a difference. That's the real challenge.
Jonathan, the answer is it is going to be an issue, but we already have seen in Iowa a very strange phenomenon in which one of the very conservative, probably the most conservative Republican running, but Mr. Vanderplaats, suddenly has shifted to started talking about jobs. He's even started talking about, making it easier to get legal immigrants from other countries who want to come and start companies in Iowa to stimulate the economy and start innovation. This is a conservative Republican talking about immigration. That's very interesting. So, yes, they're going to talk about health care, but obviously everyone understands that jobs and unemployment and the economy are really the number one hot button, and the Republicans have got to have some very, very specific answers. Terry Branstad, former Governor Terry Branstad, four-term Governor Terry Branstad, has been running a couple of ads that people in Iowa have seen. Arnie probably hasn't seen them, but they're terrific ads in the sense that they are almost sort of like Ronald Reagan. It's the shining city on the hill. They have some nice, beautiful rural churches and stuff. And Terry Branstad says, I'm going to create 200 and some thousand jobs. I know how to do that. You know, I've been governor. That's where we're going to go. I didn't see him mention health care reform in those ads. So I think health care reform is going to be a piece of the discussion. But I think any Republican who wants to bank the party and bank the whole brand of the Republican Party on health opposition, to health care reform is making a serious mistake.
I mean, and it's a little bit hard to beat a fait accompli. Do you know what I mean? It's done with. I mean, the fact that we have to create high-risk insurance pools, the fact that we have to deal with Medicare and Medicaid, the fact that we have to do state exchanges, the fact that we have to have nationwide health plans, the fact that we have to have cost-cutting measures, all these things are in the bill, individual mandates, all of them. They go out to 2016. Yeah. They go out to 2020. The problem is that people operate on yesterday, today, and tomorrow. That's it, Jonathan. No.
Well,
that's how they operate.
And you guys know that I love to bring up the past, and I remember one election that was dominated by one line. It's the economy, stupid.
Oh, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how that happens. Coming up after this break, we'll take a couple of phone calls, talk a little bit more about healthcare and other political issues with Arnie Artisan and Stefan Schmidt. I'm Jonathan Aull. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Artisan are our guests for Politics Day. We're also taking your emails and phone calls. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. Let's go to Dell in Sac City. Dell, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call, Jonathan, Stefan, and Arnie. I'm a Republican. But I'm getting to be less of one all the time. Congressman John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, following the passage of the health care bill, was hollering, shame on you, repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And I envision him actually looking in the mirror and saying this actually to himself, shame on you. Now, the Republicans had their chances. In 1994, the health care bill was defeated in the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. The Republicans then had control of both houses and the presidency for a long time. Yet they chose to do nothing for health care. And instead of being proactive now, they simply are on defense. Now, this health care bill passes, and all they're doing is just playing obstructionist. So my comment to Congressman John Boehner and the Republicans is, shame on you. You folks let us down. And I hope our citizens are smart enough to realize that that the Republicans are just probably incapable of dealing successfully with health care reform. It has to happen, so I think let's let the have the Democrats have a shot at it.
Del, let me ask you a quick question. As a self-described Republican, are there other issues that you think the Republicans are much stronger on, and are those bigger issues in your mind than health care, and might that keep you voting Republican?
You know, I don't look at them as particularly strong on anything.
But then why are you a Republican?
You know, all they can do is just say no to things. And, you know, when you have a party voting 100% against a particular item, this tells me that our real statesmen are not there. I think probably the quality of our elected officials is just not that high, and they don't. Where are the Senator Everett Dirksens and the Bob Doles when we need them? They aren't even there. They aren't capable of coming to consensus and working something out. They're just obstructionists. So I think our number one thing is we have to look for quality first.
Thanks, wow. Del. I really do appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. Let's go to another call real quick here. Dan in Fort Dodge is on the line. Dan, welcome to the show.
Good morning. On cost control in the healthcare field, it's generally reported that Medicare operates on administrative costs of 5%, while the private insurance operates on administrative costs between 25 and 30%. Yet Medicare, according to 60 Minutes television program, experiences $60 billion worth of fraud charges and still operates at one-fifth the administrative cost of private health care. Is the cost, health care cost problems buried in the administrative expenses experienced by private health insurance to grease the palms of multi-billion-dollar executives?
Steph, Arnie, Dan, thanks for your question. Steph,
well,
Arnie,
I'll let Arnie handle that one.
There's a lot of cost shifting. Have you noticed? I mean, that's part of the problem with our system, is that it is so difficult to be able to track the dollars, because what's also ironic here is that Medicare doesn't pay an adequate amount to a lot of providers. And a lot of providers, here's their excuse, one of the rationales for the abuse of Medicare is that what doctors are getting paid under the Medicare structure is not sufficient to keep and maintain their offices. So they're going to look for a way to either double dip, overtest, do something to produce the kind of additional revenues that they need. The problem becomes, how are we going to create a system where you're not spending your time looking for, you know, additional revenues, but you can spend your time working on patient needs? I have a friend who made a fabulous suggestion. He said, don't have people be billed based on individual activity. Give every doctor like $750,000. Just divide the entire healthcare system and give them $750,000 and tell them, care for patients. Okay? And they can spend that $750,000 in any way they want, but the objective is to care for patients. Care for patients as a primary care doctor, care for patients as a pediatrician, but care for patients. And you can do what you want with the extra money. All we want to know is that you actually care for people. Maybe that's a way to control the costs, because right now everyone is trying to figure out who they bill and where they can extract the most cash. Very inefficient, very duplicative, and people's health gets compromised.
Going back to something that was referred to earlier, someone emailed in and pointed out that the Arizona legislature passed a bill giving the governor authority to circumvent the Democratic Attorney General and file a lawsuit on behalf of the state challenging the federal health care legislation. There is constitutional questions there in Arizona, though, asking if the legislature has the right to authorize circumvention of another constitutional officer. But that was pointed out by one of our emailers.
Mm. Oh, I tell you, this is going to be so much fun. I can't wait to take con law next year. It's going to be very exciting.
I'm looking forward
to healthcare
teaching
as the example.
American government next year with all of these things churning around. Yeah.
Well,
can I just ask people in Arizona, because I just came from Arizona, I'm just curious, do they want their time and attention of their officials spent on doing this when there are so many other issues that are really facing these states? I mean, Arizona is a state that just got rid of its CHIP program. Isn't this ironic? They can't provide health care for their children in Arizona, and now they're overriding the governor, and they want to sue about providing something in the way of access for health care? I mean, they're willing to sacrifice their kids, so maybe go for it.
Arnie, let me I'm curious, though, because now we're saying, well, there are all these other issues that are important, but the Democrats fought really hard for this health care bill because they said it was, you know, one of the most important things they could have done. So is it a little bit hypocritical to, before passage of it, say, this is really important, we got to get it done with 51 and all of that, and then following the passage of it, saying to the critics, well, you know, there's so many other issues, why are you spending your time fighting this?
This is about enforcement. Yeah, this is about whether, I mean, I would love to have known what the arguments were before we went to the Civil War. And look at the southern states that didn't want to embrace civil rights. It's not uncommon for states to basically want to reject a mandate from the federal government. The question then becomes a question of priorities, because the mandate is there. The override is there. Now the question is this serving your citizens well?
Well,
and that's obviously what maybe people in Arizona suspect.
You know, there's a simple solution to this. And the simple solution is for the federal government to say, fine, you know, we'll shift the resources that would have gone to Minnesota and Arizona and the other 14, 15 states to their states that would like to participate in this program, and their health care will be reinforced by it. They will create more jobs. They'll be able to work on it harder. We don't want to ram this down Arizona's throat if they don't want it. I mean, I think that's another way to go, and
But if 15 or 20 states opt out of it, then does that do, I mean, because the whole principle of the healthcare reform is that the more people you get into the pool, that's the problem with the healthcare system we have right now, is that people aren't in the system. But if you let 10, 15 states opt out, does it undermine that?
I don't think it does. I don't think it does. And anyway, I'm not sure there are many more states that are going to jump on the bandwagon of saying no to it. And there is, of course, a secondary level of this, which is the effort to sue the federal government and take them into federal court and go to the Supreme Court and say that this is actually unconstitutional. Now, if that happens, you know, that's a whole different story. And only one state attorney general has to be able to get a federal court to take the case. And then we'll see. And if the Supreme Court says this is unconstitutional, then, you know, we start all over again.
May I ask a question? Is there any state in the nation that does not take Medicaid dollars? Medicaid is not a required program, Stefan.
Yeah, I know.
You take Medicaid dollars with the understanding that if you take this dollar, you have to match the dollar.
Yeah.
If you're a rich state, it's a 50-50 match. If you're a poor state, it's an 80-20 match. So states have had a lot of opportunity to experience some sort of federal overlay when it comes to health care, and I don't believe, and I may be wrong here, so someone Google this, that there is any state that has said no to help for Medicaid. So I think it would be very interesting if those states want to sue and they want to opt out. I think you give them the check as of 2010 for Medicaid. You say that's all you get. Goodbye. You're on your own, and you figure out your own health care system, and call us sometime if you want to get back in the program. There'll be plenty of people if 30 states participate, because remember how large the United States is. And look at Norway, look at Sweden, look at France. All of them have universal health care, and they're very tiny.
We have to take a quick break for the Environment Report, but when we come back, we'll do a little bit more about health care, and then we'll talk about the FCC and internet neutrality. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa here on Iowa Public Radio. Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University, New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson are our guests on this Politics Day. We'll be back in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa.
Oil and gas prices are going up, but it's not because supplies are down. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. The Energy Information Administration's new short-term energy outlook says gasoline prices will average about $2.92 a gallon this summer, getting to above $3 a gallon in some regions. That's about 50 cents a gallon higher than last summer. The outlook also predicts oil prices to average $82 a barrel this summer. Since oil already hit $86 a barrel this week, you have to wonder what's up. Stephen Shork, an energy analyst with the Shork Report, says the government projections were put together about a week ago and didn't really anticipate investors driving up the price of oil.
So this rally that we are seeing and this upward bias is based more on investor momentum than it is on underlying fundamentals. There's plenty of oil on the market right now.
The government says prices should remain relatively stable but rising, although it notes uncertainty over crude oil price forecasts remains high. Seems we're still addicted. This is the Environment Report. Urban planners say people are being forced to spend too much gas money to get to and from work. The government sees the problem in regions around the country, and it's ready to spend millions of dollars to plan improvements that put jobs and housing closer together, or at least give people more transportation options to get to work. Julie Grant reports on how the government plans to do that.
For decades, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has built housing in one part of a community, while the Department of Transportation invested in another with no coordination. That's one reason why highways often bypass rural communities entirely and split inner-city neighborhoods in two. Dwayne Marsh works within a new office within HUD that's working to integrate housing planning with the Department of Transportation as well as the Environmental Protection Agency.
Now we're working really hard to eliminate those barriers and to make sure that when communities are getting federal resources, they can be used in synchronous ways.
The three agencies have $140 million in grants for local governments and regions around the country to do better planning, what they call planning for sustainability.
You know, I'm snarky about the whole thing about sustainability.
Ned Hill is dean of the College of Urban Affairs at Cleveland State University. He says sustainability means so many different things to different people. To him, sustainable goes beyond environmental effects.
At the foundation of any sort of sustainability is have an economy that's sustainable. And for the older industrial cities, our first challenge is to reload the economy.
In many of those older cities, as people have moved farther into the suburbs, they've started new businesses close to where they live. Highways have been built to connect the different suburbs, and people are driving all over the place to get to work in those suburbs. But getting to work is now the second biggest expense for most Americans after housing. Dwayne Marsh says the White House is sending agencies a clear message. They need to help get the economy back on track, and that means making sure people can afford housing, that they don't have to spend a bundle and destroy the environment trying to get to work.
And because the federal government plays a role in all of those activities, we need to be fostering the innovation coming from local communities that can take on some of our toughest national problems. And it certainly need to make sure that we're not an impediment to that creativity.
Marsh says his HUD office will work with the Transportation Department and the EPA to help instead of getting in the way of local areas' creative solutions.
And that's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson are our guests on this Politics Day. Right now we are talking about health care, and we're going to take a phone call. Dennis from Marion County is on the line. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd like to ask Arnie and Dr. Politics if what their thoughts are on the senator from Oklahoma that's a doctor, and I'm embarrassing myself a little bit because I think his name is Colburn.
Colburn.
Yeah, he had a town hall meeting this week. And in the town hall meeting, people started shouting about all the terrible things in the health care bill. And his response to it was, you need to stop just watching Fox News. You need to get other sources for your information. And then a bit later, he mentioned Nancy Pelosi, and they started booing. And he said, just because you disagree with somebody doesn't mean you have to treat them poorly. She's a very nice lady, et cetera, et cetera. So it would seem to me, considering he's one of the conservative leads on this whole thing, that he's recognizing that there's really a change that is necessary to move forward for the conservative movement. And I would expect health care may be an issue, going to your real question, but I think it'll be a much more civil issue. And I'd just be interested in hearing your take on that. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis. Seth, Arnie, what's your take on that?
Wow. I'm not sure it's as much focused on health care, I think, as it may be focused on the tone and the lack of civility, and that there's a ramping up of anger and militia activity and frustration, and they're they're building an extreme sort of conversation in this country that probably has Senator Coburn very worried. Because after all, he is a doctor. He did take the Hippocratic Oath. And while he may have been very unhappy with the result of the health care reform, I think he may be more frightened by what he sees happening around him. And it doesn't speak to the fact that health care is the right issue as he sees it. But I think what he doesn't want to see is that he doesn't want to see democracy dissolve. And I am afraid, Jonathan, I will publicly admit that I have never seen it so acrid. I'm 56. I haven't lived that incredibly long. But it feels more frightening than the 60s and the 70s. And especially because they're using healthcare reform as a divisive issue, which to me is so mind-boggling. I mean, I understand fighting about a war. I can't understand about fighting about going to a doctor. I really can't. Well, I can't.
Let me add on to Arnie. I'm a little bit older than Arnie, but I remember the Vietnam War protests very well. I was at Columbia University when the university was taken over by SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and by a group of Black Panthers who took over a different building. I remember the level of acrimoniousness. I remember that the SDS actually broke into and occupied the office of the president of Columbia and was looking for all of the agreements with the Defense Department on Columbia University's research on defoliants that were used in Vietnam. I remember seeing in the evening news my mentor and best professor being clubbed over the head and being taken to jail because he was part of the protest. And I remember crying during my oral comprehensives, not because they were so difficult, but because the tear gas was floating through the Latin American center. The campus was closed because there were so much riots going on. And I was crying because and my professors who were questioning me were in tears because the tear gas was so thick. So I think we have seen a lot worse than this, and I also know that we have seen passions running very high, and so far this has been, you know, really sort of hecklers, the heckler's veto being exercised. But I think that's the price you pay in a democracy. I think Jonathan has mentioned it before. You know, people get very, very upset, and it could be over healthcare, but I think I'm going to be quoted in the big story that's coming out in the Sunday Des Moines Register on all of this. And my comment was, people are not upset about healthcare reform. They're upset about a whole chain of things that have gone away in this country: morality, the quality of schools, the incredible explosion of sexual crimes, of a failing education system, jobs going away, the threat of China really overshadowing the U.S. and becoming the dominant power in the world. And healthcare reform and huge budget overruns are the closest thing that you can actually get your fingers around, because those other issues, I mean, where do you go to protest those mega trends that are unsettling people, especially people who sort of feel that the next generations are going to be worse off than they are, you know? So this is a manifestation of something much bigger.
Your point is incredibly accurate, because it is synergistic. It is bigger than the whole. There is no question about it. I just wrote a piece about who, in fact, are the Tea Party protesters. Yeah. You know, and when you look at how I sort of defined them, I didn't define them on health care. I didn't define them on guns. I didn't define them on the loss of jobs. I didn't define them on the changing demographics in America. It's all of those things. It's all of those things. And they come to a critical head. What I think Senator Coburn was so worried about was that, is the Republican Party using all that anxiety in order to win, but will that anxiety ultimately undermine the government that is necessary for the country, which is why I think he is attempting to pull it back. And remember, he comes from Oklahoma, where there is probably a strong segment of the population that is very angry, and it needs to be people like him that rein it in. It has to be his voice, because mine could never be heard.
Let's shift gears here, because we could talk about healthcare for shows and shows, and I'm sure we'll get to it again next week and the week after that. Earlier this week, the FCC lost a court ruling, Comcast, a legal issue with them, talking about the issue of net neutrality. And maybe the quickest way to try to discuss this really complicated issue is, Internet providers want to have the ability to regulate the some of the data that moves down and back and forth on the internet. They claim it's about file size and usage. There's some concern that it can be more about directing content to certain paid advertisers or censorship or those kinds of things. But it looks like the FCC now has a lot less authority over the internet and how internet providers treat data than they used to. Steph and Arnie, is this an issue that is going to get down to the common person? Is it going to get anybody upset and fired up? Because right now it's kind of been lurking in the background.
Well, I think the frightening thing was that it really sort of says to the FCC that this is not your area of responsibility. And if it's not the FCC, then who is it? We've sort of entered into this brave new world. And you know what this kind of reminds me of? We created, and I'm going to take this back to another problem of regulation and who is in fact responsible for oversight and enforcement. We created a number of years ago the concept of the non-bank. It acts like a bank. It looks like a bank, but it ain't a bank, but it makes a lot of money. And it turns out that why it thrived so well is it had no regulation, but it also drove the economy sort of into the ground. Well, what Comcast is saying is, you know, I want to be kind of a media communications company, but I don't want any oversight by the FCC. You just have to trust me. And I'm thinking, why? And Stefan, let's remember that in a lot of communities, there are no choices.
No, there,
there are no choices. It's either Verizon or AT&T or Comcast, and people could say we can go to somewhere else. Really? Where?
Well, I my concern is, and I've written about this, and one of my former students is the number two guy in the FCC right now in the Obama administration. He was a speechwriter and kind of a personal advisor to Bill Gates. And we've talked about this issue. One of the real problems is that this now means that these internet service providers can actually sort of slow down the progression of their ability to deliver and to allow people to use the internet. They don't have to invest as much in bigger pipes and in bigger bandwidth and in faster servers and so on. They can just sit on the technology as it is by just choking off. For example, they want to charge YouTube to deliver their content faster to users. That'll happen next. So when you want to download something from YouTube, you're not going to be able to do it for free if this continues. This is like, you know, charging you $20 to bring your carry-on bag onto the airplane and stick it in the overhead bin, which one airline will start to do in a few weeks. So it is a blow to not just consumers using the internet, but also a blow to the fact that when people are using something in enormous quantity, it means there is an enormous demand for it, and you should invest in faster, better, and less expensive delivery systems rather than rationing it. So that's one of my concerns.
Well, and one more point here is that let's also remember that this is we're into a brave new world where your phone service, your videos, your television, even your media content will be basically provided by one company. Like Comcast is doing this. It'll be one high-speed bandwidth connection. That's what it's going to be. So there isn't even going to be diversity or options within those connections because one company will be providing it. And Comcast is talking about buying some of the content. And at the NFL, what is it, NBC, is that what they're doing? I can't remember which company they're talking about purchasing. But that's where it gets really scary. And if there is no FCC to step in, if it has no right to offer or encourage some kind of regulation, then we now become vulnerable to these institutions. And these institutions control our knowledge.
Of course, there's still something that is out there. I don't have Comcast. I live in a rural area. We don't get anything there. So I have a satellite dish, and I get all of my cable, not from cable, but from satellite. And I think what could happen in this situation is a company that chokes off consumers and makes them angry may end up spawning new companies that will provide that bandwidth, that will innovate, and that will basically start taking customers away from the ones who have a semi-monopoly. And I think, you know, it's not very difficult to slap a little satellite dish on the side of your house in places where you don't have an option on cable company, and you can get a lot of good programming very reasonably. And, you know, I have a friend who uses a Hughes internet access, from which is downloaded from a Hughes satellite system to a little receiver. You can actually take that with you. One of our wonderful colleagues, Jill Preetz, who is one of these young new anthropologists who has this fantastic research for National Geographic in Senegal, we equipped her with a Hughes satellite service so that she could do broadband through satellite from Senegal, and it worked terrific, and there was no Comcast involved. So I think this could be, in a sense, the worst thing that ever happened to Comcast, because if they start using a heavy hand, you know, this is still a country of a lot of entrepreneurs, especially in this particular area, and for sure somebody is going to start developing alternatives and competing. So.
Well, Stefan, I think there's two issues with that. First of all, that the argument is that the startup costs to start serving a community of any size with broadband is prohibitive. That's one of the arguments. The other argument is that there's some concern that people won't completely know how their internet service providers are regulating the content. They won't realize that if you go to a search engine and put in a word, that some sites don't come back because they're not what the internet service provider, the sites they want you to go to. Can both of you comment on those two?
Yes,
issues?
I can, real quickly.
Oh,
Jonathan All will tell them. I mean, you know, unless they buy out Iowa Public Radio and you become a zombie clone of the large internet media companies. I mean, this is a community of people who don't take anything lying down, and there are going to be all kinds of heck rays, and it's going to be very easy for cyber geeks to identify what companies are doing, where they're choking off, how they're doing it. Wired Magazine and Wired Online is going to have articles. They're going to have little video blogs. And everyone will be talking about it very quickly. So this is not the kind of thing, I think, where you can hide it in secret. It will become a really big issue very soon. Anyway, that's my comment.
Well, you have a point. But what really frightens me is that, let me just quote you something. A company is now allowed to sell you internet service and not tell you that your internet will be limited to what they'd like you to see, hear, and use on the internet. That's what this decision says.
Arnie, we're not interested in talking about China. So stick with the U.S.
No,
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. But doesn't that sound like China?
It sounds like China.
It does.
Yeah.
So now China and Comcast have a lot more in common than we knew.
It sounds a lot like China.
I mean, what
China.
Is that too? Yeah. And you're absolutely right that there will be some potential for visibility. And an informed citizen will know that. And someone who is curious will know it. But the rest of us, you know, may not know it, and it may not get to the internet site we're looking for. And I think those of us who really do care about net neutrality are looking at this decision, and we are horrified.
Well, I think the internet companies are also, the other way that they're pitching this is that it's not about content blocking, but they want to have the right to offer an internet package to someone who all they do is email and maybe a couple of websites for $19.95 a month. And then someone who's uploading video files and using a lot more bandwidth, they have to pay $39.95 a month or whatever. They're kind of pitching it in that way as well.
Right, but the decision by the court was not that.
Exactly.
The decision by the court was the FCC has no oversight.
That's
that was
right.
The decision.
Which is,
and Comcast is smiling. They'll send out a press release to say whatever they want to say to make you a happy camper. What makes the rest of us unhappy is when we realize that there basically is no regulator.
Former FCC Chairman Michael Powell this morning, in a story that was on Morning Edition earlier today, his advice was that Congress needs to get involved and pass a law that specifically gives the FCC the authority over the internet. Let's get this back to the politics aspect.
Oh, sure.
Do you think there's political will to do that, political interest to do that?
I think there is, because it does affect enormous part of the American public. Now, whether it's high on the list of things in the current Congress or the next Congress to do is another question. But, I mean, I think that is obviously an appropriate area for Congress to regulate. It's not airwaves. The only problem is, you know, that these are proprietary fiber optic lines and it's private companies and it's not over the airwaves.
Let me remind you about Citizens United. How convenient that that Supreme Court decision comes down, because can you imagine the kind of ads Comcast can run? Because they don't have to pay anyone, because they actually control the cable. They control the information. They can run it under every single show they want, what their take du jour is, and they have unlimited access to the media. They have almost unlimited access to an enormous audience, and they can do it for nothing. And now Citizens United said they can even spend more money if they want as an independent expenditure during a campaign. If we think finance reform is difficult because of the influence of the big banks and Goldman Sachs, imagine this.
866-780-9100 is our number if you have a question or comment on this respect. But tying this back to what we talked about earlier with healthcare, and you know, is net neutrality something that is going to be on anyone's front burner anytime soon when there are issues of the economy? There's still two wars going on. There's the healthcare issues. Immigration is a big issue that is probably going to come up again. And then that doesn't even get into people's individual issues that you know, motivate them in terms of abortion or other same-sex marriage or other social issues that may be on the front burner in some people's minds. Does net neutrality ever get anywhere close?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't until people start losing their ability to do the things that they've been used to doing on the internet. And when they start seeing, I mean, people will notice right away that some things are just not working the way they were. They'll begin to get new packages, as you said. You know, if you want to stream so many, you know, it's kind of like the electric bill, you know, where you're going to be clocked and you're going to be charged by how much bandwidth you're using every month. And they start getting these horrendous bills because now all of a sudden, you know, people are using a lot of media. You think Netflix and all those other internet service companies or companies that produce products that are delivered through the internet are not already getting their lawyers lined up and getting pressure on Congress? I mean, there are a lot of companies that are going to be very heavily hit in a negative way by this, if this begins to happen. And all of them are big players, too. And they're all over the country. And they're going to start pressuring their legislators to begin to look into this, because they're not going to want to have their business model all of a sudden affected by an enormous price inflation for streaming a movie or something like that. And so I think there is going to be a war that is going to be fought more in the private sector, because this is a competing and conflicting interest between companies that want to regulate this and charge and so on, and companies that have made their entire business model. I mean, Apple, you know, what's going to happen when people get their tablet and they want to stream and they're connected to their Wi-Fi network is connected somehow, or they are connected to a company that is going to start charging them extra? A lot of people are going to be angry in the business community because this is a blow to their profitability. So I think it's not just consumers. It's also other people who are going to be.
Sadly, Jonathan, I think most people on the street don't even know what net neutrality means.
They don't. Right?
And they don't. What they do know is their cable bill.
Right.
Okay? And somehow if we can tie it to their cable bill, we will all be upset. But until we can tie it to the cable bill, net neutrality really, you know, there's a lot of activists who care about it. But for the most part, just as you were describing, what did Comcast say? You know, what was their response to this? They didn't really interpret accurately the Supreme Court decision. They did it in such a way to basically make sure that the public was not going to be concerned about this. And frankly, the public won't be concerned until there's a direct hit. And that's what happened to the what happened in finance was that, you know, in the beginning, everybody loved the subprime until they found out that the subprime market exploded before them. Then it wasn't a good thing anymore.
Well, the FCC,
and only until it explodes do people care.
Right. But the FCC can still do some things. You know, they can appeal Comcast's win to a full panel of the Federal Circuit Court, or they can appeal it to the Supreme Court. The FCC can also do something else. They can actually try to reclassify ISPs, Internet Service Providers, and call them Title II service providers, which are phone companies. Phone companies are, in fact, legitimately regulated by the FCC. And if the FCC reclassifies companies like Comcast and others as a Title II service provider, they can implement the same regulations that they do on phone companies. So this isn't over yet. There is a lot of really complicated, cool, bureaucratic and legal stuff that's going to go on behind the scenes.
And I don't think they want to go to the Supreme Court, at least not the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court will probably side with Comcast because it tends to err in that direction anyway.
Right.
So if they can figure out a way to do it internally by redefining, they may try.
Exactly.
Stefan Schmidt, Arnie Arneson, thank you both for your time. We will talk to you again next week.
Great. Wonderful.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. It's produced by Dennis Reese. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Podcasting and on-demand audio of the program is available at iowapublicradio.org. We welcome questions and comments about the program. Contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for listening.